Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Cozy Sheridan. Sheridan is one of the preeminent singer-songwriters on the folk music scene today. She documents the lives of women and tackles important issues such as child abuse, AIDS, and body image. She has appeared all over the country in such places as Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, and the Falcon Ridge Folk Festival. And fusing myth with modern culture, she recently released her 9th CD. It's called Eros, and it's on Wind River Records. I'm speaking to Cozy Sheridan by phone from New Hampshire. Cozy Sheridan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, do you remember what prompted you to begin writing songs in the first place?
Well, when I was a kid, my guitar teacher in Concord, New Hampshire, when I was about 12 or 13, I think, just suggested it to me. I think he thought, well, let's have this kid try writing some songs, and I wrote one, I think, about my dollhouse, actually. but I don't play any of those songs out. The songs that I play out now, as we say, I started writing in my 20s, and I wrote, I think, as a lot of people do, to try to figure out my own world, you know, try to translate my experience into words that made sense to me.
And have you ever written poetry?
I have. I write poetry as a way to relax, actually. I read a lot of poetry. I spend a lot of time at night just relaxing, reading actually Mary Oliver poetry and Lee Collins and some what I think we would consider very popular poets. But for me, writing poetry is very relaxing because I don't think of it as something where I'm going to have to translate my idea to an audience. As a songwriter, I feel that when I am writing a song for a performance, it's my responsibility to impart the idea as clearly as possible and in as artistic way as possible. And for me, poetry, I write for myself, and so it's more about playing with the words and, you know, the imagery that might mean something only to me.
And the subject of many of your songs focuses on women's lives. Is a lot of your material autobiographical?
Yes, it is. Not all of it. In the beginning, it was much more autobiographical. As I've gotten older, I'm trying to tell, I think, a larger story now, just as an older woman, more interested in the universal experience. So a lot of it is my experience, but I might have used my emotional experience with somebody else's specifics. For instance, I have a song called Agnes of the Sorrows about young women who are cutters at a college where I interviewed some women. And that's not my experience specifically, but I certainly remember in my 20s and even now the concept of, you know, will I feel better if I feel more or if I feel less? And that is the whole idea in the chorus is, you know, will I feel better if I feel more or if I feel less? And you don't have to be a cutter to understand that idea.
Now, in 2003, you actually created a one-woman show called The Pomegranate Seed, an exploration of appetite, body image, and myth in modern culture. To tell us more about this.
I wrote that as part of a project. I was getting a bachelor's degree in psychology in my early 30s, and my teacher said, well, you need a final project. And I was studying archetypes, and she had me look at some various myths, and the myth of Persephone really spoke to me, and the idea of the seed, eating the pomegranate seed with women who have eating disorders. Now, I had an eating disorder as an adolescent, so I have some experience with that, and I've written some songs about that. And so I decided what I was interested in is how do people go down to the underworld with body image issues and eating disorders, and how do they return? So I wrote it as a academic project, but once I was done with that, then I went back and rewrote almost all of it to make it much more user-friendly for an audience.
And it must resonate with a lot of audience members. You must have women coming up to you after they see this.
Yeah, I do. I get a lot of women, especially women who are actually older. The younger women who come to see the show, a few very brave ones will come up and say thank you for telling my story. But it's harder when you're that age. And the older women who have had it or are still struggling, and in fact, there's now a lot of recurrence for women who are having midlife crisis. Often, they're much more verbal about it, and they do come up, and it's very rewarding to have somebody say thank you. You know, it's an amazing thing.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the thing with these kinds of disorders. You need to talk about them. And do you think the fact that we have been talking about this in our culture for a great deal of time now has helped?
Yeah, certainly it has helped because we're talking about it. In the 80s, when I was going in high school, nobody was talking about it on that level, I don't think. And now, when I go to these schools, I mean, they've had, you know, every year they have somebody come in and talk to them about it, so they're very aware of it. Whether it's meaning that it's all going away, I don't think so. I think it's still part of our culture that we are a boiling pot of, you know, stresses and tensions. And if you're a young woman, there's there's the possibility that you're going to need to let the steam out in less than functional, you know, or in a way that might be a little destructive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, this culture really is hard on young women, especially about their body image. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very hard on them. Mm-hmm.
Now, you also deal with subjects such as pedophilia and child sexual abuse and AIDS. Are you also an activist on behalf of some of these issues?
Am I an activist? I'm not actively out there at conferences discussing that. If I'm an activist in anything, it's body image issues and eating disorders. I've had experiences with all those other things in one way or another, and I put them into the second act of the pomegranate seed. It's about, you know, other ways you can go down to the underworld. Can you go down to the underworld through, you know, sexually transmitted diseases or through an inappropriate sexual contact with an older person? But no, I wouldn't call myself an activist. In general, I'm an artist who is interested in telling the truth about our experiences, but I think that's slightly different than being an activist.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's your responsibility as an artist to bring up some of these issues and explore them with your listeners and audience?
I think it's my responsibility, and I would only say my, I wouldn't say everyone's. I feel it's my responsibility to, if I bring it up, to have a way that I don't leave my audience shattered.
Mm.
I feel it's my responsibility, if I'm going to bring up a difficult subject, to have some way of reaching closure, even if it's to say, okay, this is a hard situation and we don't know how to solve it, but to do something that doesn't just throw it out there and say, here's a lot of blood on the stage. And when I was younger and I wasn't quite sure what I was doing, I think I had some moments where I just said, here's my experience, and I now really want to make sure that I say, here is a experience, here's how it is a universal experience, and here's how it can be transformed.
I think that's great. I also want to talk about your new CD, Eros. Tell us how that whole creation happened. It's an entire theme, and it's a lovely, lovely CD.
Thank you. After doing the pomegranate seed, I started turning around in the back of my head the idea of another CD that would be a song cycle following one mythic idea. And the idea was the myth of Eros and Psyche. And it took me a number of years to amass the songs that all kind of worked with that, but my idea was following that myth of a person who falls in love with the god of love, which of course is idealized love, and then how love often disappoints us. It can fail us at moments because of either the person we fall in love with or how we've chosen to interpret love. And in the myth, Psyche falls in love with the god of love. He then deserts her, and she has to go searching for him, and when she finally finds him again, they both matured enough that they have a much more mature relationship. And that's what I was trying to follow through the songs is, you know, we start out with this idealized idea of love. It often fails us in some way. And in that failing and in the fact that we are disappointed by it, we end up finding how we are our own god of love. In a song I have called The Seed of Misfortune, I say, you know, I realize that I am the feathers in light. We all end up realizing that we have to be our own access to love.
Mm-hmm. Now, I actually want to play an excerpt from Eros, and this piece is called Do You Love the Life You Made? To tell us a bit about it, and then let's listen to it.
This song, I think of it as my big statement, certainly for the past few years of this song. It took me a long time. The song is probably not less than 3 minutes, but it really says, for me, it says everything. Everything unravels. Everything will fade. Do you love the life you made? And that, for me, is here I am. I'm 44. I've had various positive and negative experiences in my life, and I finally come to the point of realizing, well, it's not whether I'm succeeding on anybody else's yardstick, it's do I love what I'm doing? And this idea seems to translate to a lot of people. A number of people have said this song really speaks to their experience.
Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Dishes in the kitchen, the elder in the cage. Why not have a life that gets up off the page? Open up your mouth, sing your most fervent hope. How much of your life will you stuff down your throat? It's a miracle you have not given.
That's great. I love your lyrics.
Thank you.
Now, why do you think folk music continues to resonate with so many people, but the genre, it doesn't really create superstar careers like rap and pop and country and so on?
Well, it might be where we are in the sine wave of our culture right now. You know, for instance, Tracy Chapman had quite a career on folk music in the 80s, early 90s, and Suzanne Vega. So there was a time when the singer-songwriter, which I think is more what I'm doing, was more in the public view. And actually, I think I remember a songwriter saying the worst thing ever happened to folk music was when we got really popular, because all of a sudden people wanted to use it as a venue for fame. But right now, it's again in a situation where it's talking to people under the radar, and I think that's one of its strengths. Number one, the artist is accessible. You see them in a venue small enough that they're a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're not motivated entirely by a monetary gain, because it's not an available avenue necessarily in this particular musical form, we're a lot more straightforward about what we're saying, because we're not worried about, you know, are we offending the advertisers, you know, are we doing this or that, are we, you know, tweaking society in just this way that we'll become famous. I think folk music, because it's, if we're going to call it folk, although I might call it singer-songwriter,
mm-hmm.
a bit of a different genre, because it's not necessarily the most popular music in the culture, it just ends up maintaining its honesty.
Mm-hmm. And I talk to so many folk artists who actually are independents, which offers up, obviously, a lot of freedom.
Right, we are. I mean, I play in a lot of people's living room. I'm not beholden to anybody. It's very independent.
Uh-huh. Now, you've actually been called a Buddhist monk in a 12-step program trapped in the body of a singer-songwriter. I love that.
Yeah, that was quite a quote.
That was from the Albuquerque Journal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What do you think about that label?
Well, a lot of it still holds. I mean, that was from, I think, the late 90s when he wrote that. But I think a lot of it still holds. I'm not an active Buddhist, nor am I in a 12-step program, but I have a lot of those ways of approaching life. You know, I have a very philosophical mind bent. I'm very interested in self-discovery and in self-empowerment and in addressing, you know, self-destructive behaviors, which would fit into all those things. And I am, you know, trapped in the body of a singer-songwriter. That's the medium I'm working through.
Uh-huh. You seem to be somewhat of a teacher with some of your music. I mean, it's not hard sell, but it's almost like you are there to help.
Right. Well, thank you.
Lead people.
I love teaching, and I do teach. I teach a lot of songwriting workshops and performance workshops. So I happen to love to teach, and I think I bring some of it into my performance.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cozy Sheridan. She's a singer-songwriter, and she has a new CD called Eros, which we're talking about, among other things. Now tell us a little bit about your songwriting process. Do you have lines pop into your head or melodies? How does that work for you?
In the beginning, things popped into my head, and occasionally it still happens, but I've been doing it now for 20 years. So now it's more a matter of sitting down and taking the things that I know, here's a stream and here's a melody that I know works and here's an idea, and waiting for sort of synergy to occur. You know, it's that I know that if I put these two chemicals together and I just tweak the amounts just enough, at a moment there will be a burst of energy. And it's that burst of energy, for instance, in Do You Love the Life You Made, when I came up with Everything Unravels, Everything Fades, Do You Love the Life You Made, that was my synergy. I had all the verses for a long time, but the chorus took forever because I needed to figure out, where's the energy here? And that's what I'm looking for now. I sit down every day and I play guitar for 2 or 3 hours and, you know, work on writing when I'm home off the road. And I just amass a lot of stuff, and some of it gets thrown out and some of it gets kept.
And do you ever find that some of the songs that you've penned end up sounding differently in front of an audience than you would have expected? And do you change lines?
I change some songs, yes, I do. You write it, or I write it and I experience it in my home and I play it for myself. And then there's always a period of taking a song out the first couple times and finding out whether or not it translates across to the audience. And there's some songs where you can think, this will probably work. There's some songs where you know, this is definitely going to work. And there's some songs where you think, this may not work at all. And often you're surprised. you know, by what your assumption was and what actually happens, it's hard to know what the universal is and where the collective unconscious will intersect with your own experience.
Have you ever started writing something and said, oh, no, I'm not going to go there?
No, because if it's going somewhere even a little bit dangerous to me, there's some energy there and I tend to follow it.
And you always bring it to the public for?
Let's see. I have in the past, but I might, if I'm bringing it out and if I think it's dangerous because it's speaking about somebody else's experience, I may cloak it a little bit.
Before we do run out of time, I want to play another excerpt from Eros. This one's called Last Love Letter. And I love this. It's kind of country influenced. To tell us a little bit about its beginnings and where it came from.
This song, I had the idea for quite a while. I've become very interested in what we might call the traditional sounding genre of folk music. This sounds very much like a bluegrassy, old-timey folk song. And I just love the simplicity of that style, and I really wanted to write something in that style. And I felt this song did that.
And who does the voice with you?
That's my partner, T.R. Ritchie. He's a songwriter also, and he travels with me.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of this. It's a great song.
Thank you.
I really do love this. It almost seems like a different angle for you.
Oh, it is. It's very different. It's moving in a somewhat different direction. I may or may not, you know, keep going in that direction. On this album, I've put a few of those songs on, and it works perhaps better on the album than even in the concert, where all of a sudden I'm in one genre, and you kind of go. It's a very different performance genre, that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, let's think hard about this idea. It's very different energetically.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you travel around to folk festivals and you're constantly performing. Are you influenced by some of the people that you meet at some of these festivals?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I'll see somebody and I'll think about it a lot. For instance, Lee, I recently saw the Claire Lynch Band, and I've been thinking a lot about Claire Lynch's singing style, very influential, and about her performance style. Pierce Pettis is somebody who I've always been a tremendous fan of. I love his writing. So, yeah, I'll see somebody and I will keep a lot of notes, as it were.
Yeah, I'll bet people are influenced, because it's a little world unto itself, it seems, these folk festivals, especially Falcon Ridge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the community that gathers every year. It's sort of a tribal event. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. Now, is it true that you live in Utah in a 1955 travel trailer turned studio?
What's true is that I live in Utah, and I have a 1955 travel turned studio in my backyard that I write in. That's where I go to write.
So you actually live in a real house.
I have a little teeny house with a little teeny trailer behind it, yep.
And do you use the trailer to actually travel, or is it a permanent studio?
Well, if you ask us for tax purposes, we still travel in it. But if you ask me for practicality, no, we don't go anywhere in it.
Is there something about that 1955 atmosphere that is conducive to you being able to relax and write songs?
No, mostly it's a separate structure away from the phone and the office.
I was fascinated when I heard that. I could just picture you sort of sitting in a little travel trailer from 1955.
It looks just like one. I mean, it's those little round, you know, silver trailers. It's very charming. There's a lot of them in the West where nothing rots. You know, there's no rust, so there's a lot of those waiting around.
Now, let's talk about the fact that you do teach songwriting. What kinds of advice do you give in regard to crafting good songs to new songwriters?
I often mostly work with what they have, because as far as overall advice, I have very few things except, you know, have something you want to say, and say it concisely. Have something you care about. Make sure it's something you care deeply about, because if you care deeply about it, then your emotional energy will translate into the song.
Mm-hmm.
And to learn the craft. You know, there are tools, and learn how to use the tools.
Mm-hmm. And how important do you think the music and melody is in folk music? Or are the lyrics still of the utmost importance, do you think?
I think it depends on the performer. But in general, I would say in folk music, our melodies are important. You know, in rap music, the melody is not making a big difference anymore. But in folk music, the melodies are one of the richest traditions we have. You know, traditional folk melodies are glorious.
Oh, they are.
And we have this wellspring to draw upon. And why not take advantage of it?
Are you somebody who has listened to the old folk songs and the old folk singers from the past? Or are you influenced by them?
I listen to them a lot. I don't listen to them now, but certainly in my teens and 20s when I was starting out, I listened to a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's important for people who want to become folk singers to know about the history?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure there's people out there who don't necessarily need to know the history and write glorious songs. It was useful for me, mostly on the tool level of realizing, oh, here's somebody who did something interesting with a song.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily for the historic knowledge, or like anybody looking at another artist, how did they use their tools or their craft?
Mm-hmm. We're not out of time yet, so I want to play Weekend Workshop from Eros. It's a great song. To tell us a little bit about it before we play it.
Well, I have a number of these songs that, for better or worse, we sometimes call the Chronicles of Our Heroine Chlamydia, but they're my alter ego writing about life. And this was written just as I call it my full disclosure statement I send out in advance of my arrival. I'm a New Englander. I'm from New Hampshire. I'm very much a product of, you know, having grown up in the Northeast. And now I travel a lot in the New Age world. And there's some things that my inner pilgrim just isn't comfortable with, and that's why I wrote this song.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it.
If I come to your weekend workshop, do I have to dance to a drum in a field? I've spent 43 years learning to use my words to show how I feel. Don't put me with 25 strangers and then tell me to just let go. I've been in couples therapy. Show me something I don't already know. When I read the brochure that you mailed me, it said transformative and fun. How did I guess that meant get undressed and then beat on this drum? You can't cure me with drumming or dancing. Many, many people have tried. I'm repressed but polite. I say thank you and good night. And if they ask if I like it, well, I've lied. There might have been drumming and dancing when they landed at Plymouth Rock, but I can guess from which side. It wasn't my tribe. My people, we stand still and we talk.
It is great. It is great. And I love that last line. It sounds so much like real New England families, right?
That's true. We do. We stand still and we talk.
How much influence does your family have on you? Were you brought up in a household where you heard a lot of music? And
yes, it was very musical. My grandfather played piano at Thanksgivings. My sister was quite a pianist. So, yes, it was quite musical. And it had a lot of influence.
Mm-hmm. And do they like your music?
Yeah, my mother's my biggest fan. My sister is much more into classical music. My brother is very much into dancing, like waltzes and things like that. So, yeah, everybody's very musical.
Uh-huh. I would think so. I would actually think so. Were you trained at all in any kind of the classical traditions?
Well, I took oboe for 8 years, so I learned a lot about just reading music and the basics. I went to Berklee School of Music for just a little bit, and I took some vocal stuff, but it's not like I went to New England Conservatory and, you know, learned all that straight up and down. I learned most of mine, I think, in the folk school, which is, you know, you're out there learning from the people who are doing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, many of your songs, we can't help but notice, are very much in the storyteller vein. Did you ever entertain the idea of becoming a storyteller instead of a songwriter?
Well, I've actually started working a lot of storytelling into my music, interestingly enough that you would ask that. I now tell a lot of stories in my performances,
mm-hmm.
and that's just something I've worked into. I love telling stories. I have a song called The Pomegranate Seed that I tell a story to introduce it that's become almost part of the performance. So, yeah, my stories are starting to become actually part of the song. It's sort of this introductory story, and really enjoying how they breathe. Stories breathe differently than songs. They're much a much looser weave, but yet there is still something weaving it together. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're writing stories, are you actually writing a script, or is it something that's fluid?
No, that's interesting you say that. No, my stories I work on verbally, and I try them on stage every night, and I see what happens. It's much more of a performance art event than my songwriting, which I bring to the stage only once I'm sure it's edited completely.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of stories are you writing right now?
Well, not writing, but I'm telling. I'm working on the introduction to the song called "The Seed of Misfortune" on Eros, working on how to tell the modern story of Psyche in all her various adventures in the world. So I'm looking around for what's the perfect way to find a woman searching for love in the modern day.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you traveled a lot? Has that influenced a lot of your writing, or have you stayed put?
Well, I travel all around the country all the time. So, yeah, I think I have traveled a lot. I've been to Europe and Egypt and some places like that, to Greece as a tourist, and I love it. I love to travel. But mostly what I do is I travel around the country. So, yeah, I'm on the road half the year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think that you would be anything other than a singer-songwriter? Did you ever have any other aspirations for other careers?
For a while, I was very interested in the theater, but when I was about 19, I kind of had to make a decision, and that's where I went.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can you tell us about any new songs that you might be working on?
Right now, I am still working on stories. Actually, I'm working on the stories to introduce the songs I've already written. That's where my creative energy is going right now. I am thinking about some songs, but they are not even far enough out in the world yet to discuss where they're going. I'm sort of in a nascent creative period when it's a big cloud of just energy.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you influenced by politics of the last 8 years? I've had so many guests on who feel like the culture has changed because of the election of Obama. Were you influenced by this?
I'm influenced personally, much more hopeful. I might have a crush on my president, but other than that...
I think you are not alone in that one.
Well, that's what I've been told by other people, too, yeah. But it hasn't yet influenced me on a songwriting level, I guess would be the answer.
Mm-hmm. And when you're going to these festivals, did you meet a lot of people who are political in the Joan Baez and Bob Dylan kind of way?
I certainly meet some of them, yeah. And there's people who are, you know, doing some really good activist things out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Cozy Sheridan, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We are almost out of time. Can you please give a contact so people can get in touch with you if they'd like?
Sure. My website's the best way. It's CozySheridan.com, and that's Cozy with an S, C-O-S-Y, Sheridan like Wyoming, CozySheridan.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Please go out and buy her CD. It's called Eros, and anything that you have recorded is just wonderful, Cozy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.